Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our director talk for Oppenheimer. Thank you all for coming. My name's Nikki. I work here in the Royal Shakespeare Company. My pleasure to welcome Tom Morton Smith and Angus Jackson, the writer and the director of Oppenheimer. Angus, I just wondered, we asked you this earlier, whether you could give us a short plot synopsis of the play that everybody's going to see, so we're all on the same page.
Yeah, so Nikki asked me to set it up, and then I'm sure Tom doesn't want me to give anything away. They split the atom immediately before the Second World War. This is something you may know, you may not know. So then this is how the play starts, with the splitting. When people ask me what it is, I say it starts with the splitting of the atom, and it ends with Nagasaki, which is what happened. So they've suddenly got the opportunity. It took them much longer than you'd expect to realise that, well, they realised, I think, that theoretically you could use, you split an atom, you release a colossal amount of energy. This we all know, right, from GCSE chemistry and physics. So theoretically they knew then you could build a bomb. It took them a while to get around to it. Lots of politics. Obviously America entering the war in the Pacific, the war in, you guys will know, depending on your generation and whether you've recently studied it, all of this. So the play has all of this scope, but the focus of it is this man, J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was an American physicist, not necessarily the greatest of his generation, but the man who first realised, had the initiative to actually do it. The way they talk about him, they say there were a bunch of great scientists at the time, but he's the one who went, you know this thing which is theoretically possible? I think it's practically possible. Which then got involved, and obviously there's many brilliant lines in the play, but the idea that you need a big country with a lot of resources to build a bomb, because it's difficult to get hold of the stuff and it's difficult to accomplish it. So you've then got the opportunity, the splitting of the atom, the man, the subject of our play, and the United States of America, the resources.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So Tom, this massive subject,
yes,
with lots of science knowledge. Yeah. How did it, what first sparked your interest in writing a play about Oppenheimer, and how did that then make its way to the RSC?
I don't have a background in science or physics. I've got a drama degree, and massively useful. I kind of came to develop an interest in physics in my mid-20s, I think. I was watching a documentary that was on BBC Four called Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives, which was hosted by the lead singer of a rock group that I like. It was E from the Eels, and it was all about him finding out about his father. And his father was Hugh Everett III, who was the theoretical physicist who came up with the parallel worlds theory of quantum mechanics. So he was exploring the theories and was talking to scientists who knew his father, and they talked about things like wave function collapse and the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics and the double slit experiment. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's kind of where it talks about how light is both particles and waves at the same time, and it's just mind-blowing stuff. And I kind of went, blimey, this is quite interesting, and because it's all about how the universe works. And as a writer, that's kind of what I like to look into, is like how do things work? Why are they like this? So kind of just as a bit of a hobbyist, kind of starting reading lots of popular science books, and it kind of introduced me to some of the big characters in physics of the 20th century, like Richard Feynman. I read his memoirs, which are hilarious and anecdotal, and of course he worked on the bomb project, and so he started having all these anecdotes about how he was walking around Los Alamos testing out the security there and breaking into that. He trained himself to crack into safes. So he would, so all these top secret filing cabinets and stuff, he would break into just to prove that it wasn't as secure as people wanted. Right. There's an anecdote of him toying with the guy on the guard on the main gate, because he had found a hole in the fence further down the line. So he would just go come in, wave at him, then go round, disappear out through the fence, kind of come back round, kind of wave at him again, and, and cause a security kind of issue. So
kind of not stories that you perhaps wouldn't expect scientists, as we think of them in their little box, to be doing.
Absolutely, and I think certainly an eccentric physicist like Richard Feynman, who spent most of his days kind of doing his work in strip clubs, and and he was an artist as well, and would take himself off to Rio to join the carnival playing the bongos. It's kind of like, well, that's not what a scientist is, is it? That's not what culture's told me a scientist is. So I read more and more. I started learning about Paul Dirac and Oppenheimer and Schrödinger and Lisa Meitner and Madame Wu and all these fascinating characters from physics. And I always kind of had it in the back of my head that if I were ever to get the opportunity to write a big play, it would be about physics, because it's dealing with how the universe works, and there's no bigger subject in my mind. So when a few years ago, I think it was 2011, the RSC Literary Department invited me and a bunch of other writers to come and do a workshop with their rhetoric coaches, their vocal department, and all these resources that they have, that they make available to actors when they're putting on plays. They thought it would be interesting to see what writers could gain from that. And we came up and we watched Matilda when it was in the Courtyard Theatre, and we spent some time kind of looking at the soliloquies and the and Greek chorus work on stage, and we looked at Martin Luther King's speeches and things like that, all looking at the sort of literary register that you'd need to fill a space like this or the RST. And off the back of that, because we're all supposed to be now thinking epically after these workshops, I was invited in to pitch the biggest idea I could think of. So I pitched them an 8-play play cycle on the history of 20th century physics. And they went...
this being part one?
Yeah. Well, they kind of laughed and went, yeah, no, pick one. So I thought the biggest one, of course, is the atom bomb. So I pitched that. They said, great, sounds good, go away and write the first draft. I had a year to write a first draft, and then it just kind of took off from there.
And in terms of then that movement on, Angus, when did you get involved? Did you see it very early on in its inception, or fairly finished?
I don't know how much you'd been through. I came about November, a year and 2 months ago. I just got it. Greg and Erica just handed it to me. We hadn't met. I'd just done a production of King Lear, which went to New York, and Greg had seen it. I've known Erica for 20 years. So then we did what we call workshops. So you just by January. Immediately, we met, we got on, and then you just hire 20 actors, 20 scripts, and then in a week, you just have a go at it. And at that time, I think we took two intervals. There must have been more than 4 hours of material. By and large, all the material that you'll see on stage tonight was in there, and then there was other stuff as well, and then some of it has been changed in terms of focus. But you sort of do it for the writer. So the actors are there to act it at their best ability swiftly. So then we can all sit back, particularly Tom can sit back. So we did one of those. Then about 3 months later, we did another one with a mainly different cast, by which stage you'd done another huge
redraft.
Just
for one interval this time, yeah.
Yeah, with one interval, a bit less stuff, all different actors. A bit more involved, wasn't it? It was in the big RSC rehearsal room in South London. Same sort of idea, and then everybody comes, and you know, to a great extent, it's your opportunity to go, oh well, now that I've seen that, I want to go away for 2 months and have a look at this, and then you start casting. So we did two workshops, and prior to that, you hadn't done a reading or a workshop, or had you?
No, we hadn't. I think by the time that you saw it, it was on its third draft, I think. So that was the first workshop we did, was on the third draft. And there was still quite a lot of stuff that I had no idea how on earth it would stage or how you would make it work. It was quite clear after that first workshop that some of the ideas that I had theatrically weren't communicating, weren't working, mm-hmm. so they were changed by... I had a couple of months to change them before we did another workshop. And by the end of that week, I think we'd hammered it into a shape not too dissimilar to what's on stage now, but then I went away and kind of finessed it.
And during that point when you're going away finessing, and you know you've got the gig to direct it, what sort of, do you do any research, or do you... I mean, you have a physics background, we should raise that.
Yeah, I suppose I should confess. So they didn't know this when they offered me the job, but I happened to have a degree in physics and philosophy, which...
It's kind of handy.
I didn't tell the cast for about 10 days, and then it came out. One of them just said, right, how do you know all this stuff? And I told them, and they all fell about with relief, because they thought they just hadn't done their research properly. So I would casually say to Tom, oh, is that the atomic number of, you know...
And I'd go,
So, well, the gag was I would set up Tom to answer all the physics questions because he's done all his research recently. Yeah, I mean, my stuff was all... What I actually studied was all quantum mechanics. So a lot of this is nuclear physics, which I did do. I wasn't a terribly committed student because I was directing plays all the time. Yeah, afraid so. And in fact, my physics tutor, who tried to throw me out when I was at Oxford because I spent all my time directing plays, is now the physics expert on this production of Oppenheimer. And has written an article for the programme, as has my other tutor, who's one of the people who discovered the Higgs boson. So it's been very nice coming back together with them, because the last thing they tried to do is have me thrown out of Oxford. But in answer to the question, yeah, I got a lot of books on Oppenheimer. Mainly recommend... I mean, I think I sat down with you one day and went, tell me everything I need to read.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, ordered all of them up and read them as much as I could. There's two answers. The first is, it's good in the rehearsal room as the director to be able to say, this is what happens when an atom splits, and I didn't have to do a lot of that research, I knew it. The other thing you have to do is stick to the play. If I find, anyway, I don't know, anybody else can work however they want to work, but you've got to keep coming back to the play. So there's not much point in finding out by finding the 15th book on a subject that actually somebody somewhere has said it didn't happen like that, it happened like this. Because if Tom's done his research, and he has, and it's in the play like that, you're allowed to go, well, this is the play we're doing. Now, as the RSC and as Tom Morton Smith, everything has to be absolutely rigorously researched and accurate. But my job as a director is to direct the play. So, yeah, I do loads of research to make sure I'm not caught out, and then I crack on with doing what's on the page in front of me.
Is it difficult for both of you, but you having all of that knowledge, not knowing what your audience... The audience's knowledge is going to be variable. You're going to have people that are physics experts and people that are just coming because they're in Stratford. How much do you have to put yourself in that audience's mind while you're either creating the play or while you're directing the play? Are there moments when you're going, we know what we're doing, but is this being given to the audience? Are there bits that you went back on?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, when writing it, I didn't know any of the science because I don't have that background. So I think I'm a strong believer that if you're going to be writing about a subject, then knowing nothing about it at the start is a good place to start, because the audience is probably going to be coming at it from a similar place. So anything that's interesting or enlightening or helpful to me is most likely going to be interesting, enlightening or helpful to an audience. What I was doing, I was reading an awful lot of stuff online, watching an awful lot of videos on YouTube and documentaries and all these kind of things that was explaining the physics, and then kind of filtering and condensing that through my writer's brain, I guess, mm-hmm. and kind of translating it into something dramatic. So hopefully you can come at it without knowing very much at all and still be carried along by the story, because I've hopefully tethered the science to the story. So if you understand, if in order to follow the story, it gives you access to the science.
I guess my thing is that it... For me, it works on so many levels. There are moments when I was watching, I was going, OK, I get that. Oh, no, I'm lost now. But it was a very much... I wasn't lost for long. But other people might have a cue, you know, might be going absolutely with it all the way along. And it's your job, I guess, to keep that
up in the air. Yeah, I hope you do two things. You make sure there's nothing inaccurate in it, because then the people who do know would get irritated. Mm. If you can oversimplify these things to a point where if, I mean, all of my physics guys are going to come. So we've got to make sure that they're not sitting there thinking, how did Tom and Angus let that slip through? But Peter Stein famously says, you know, he's a famous German director, very senior director now in his 70s, I bring my ignorance to the project. This is the famous Peter Stein quote in the way that Peter Brooks is about having an empty space. And you have to always, as a director, think, are we taking them with us? Are they getting it? And, of course, there'll be a material in there. We talk about tungsten being a tamper material. We don't say why tungsten's a tamper material. We could go into it. We Tom and I roughly know. But you sort of say it's the thing that reflects the neutrons back, and then that's going to cause the chain reaction to run more effectively if you're building a bomb. And I think, you know, that you measure it on the basis of if you do know, yeah, that's about right. If you don't know, yeah, it's clear what's going on. Now you can enjoy the next bit of the play.
There's great structure in the play in terms of that there are a lecture series throughout the play where, as an audience, we are treated as students, and it opens with one of those where, I mean, I went and found the script and had to write it down, because you kind of go, if you lack the ability to understand this, then you can leave. And it's held for a long time, and it's the first, you know, it's in the first few lines, and you're kind of inviting anybody who goes, I shouldn't be here, really. I mean, was that something that's always been in there?
Yeah, that opening speech of Oppie's, where he kind of walks in and treats the audience as though they're attending one of his lectures, is a bit of a provocation. It's kind of one of his famous quotes is, I can make it clearer, I cannot make it simpler. And so I have him say that. That's kind of what I'm trying to do as well. So it is kind of, yeah, engage your brain. We'll take you along. It'll be fun, hopefully. Hope you don't get left behind.
Do you want to add?
Yeah, it's very entertaining, and it's. I hope we bring the audience with us in that moment. I think the last thing you want is a bunch of people on stage who never acknowledge that what they're doing is their speciality. I think the minute you acknowledge, the minute somebody, I did a play about the financial crisis at the National by David Hare. And at some point, the character of David Hare, played by Anthony Karp, who's a terribly good actor, went, I've got no idea what's going on. And it allows 1,000 people in the National Theatre to go, great, we haven't either. So hopefully when Oppie comes out and says exactly that, you know, if you can't keep up, then go. I can't. Everybody laughs, because everybody goes, oh, great, at least we can all understand that this is going to be sophisticated. So it's not our obligation to sit going, I really hope I understand it all. Because you will understand it all, but you wouldn't necessarily in the bar be able to spiel it all back to somebody who hadn't seen the show.
Talking about your experience previously and the coming to this space, working in the space, listening to Shakespeare rhetoric, it absolutely plays to this space in terms of you invite the audience in as another character in the play, which sometimes new writing doesn't tend to do that. And also, it feels like a very historical play. One, because it is, but there's an intimate, there's a personal life, as well as this great epic story of... So it's epic and intimate. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach it as a writer and how you approach it as a director in terms of the difference between the points when it's perhaps a more... like a lecture and the moments when we are truly seeing a scene from life?
I think my one of the fundamental things that I was interested in when writing it was that the play is called Oppenheimer, and it's not called the Manhattan Project. It's not called building the atomic bomb. It's very much about him and his personal journey. So it's all about his relationships, and it's all about his politics, and it's all about how he starts in a very idealistic place and becomes more and more cynical. It's about how he betrays people, and all of those things are very much about him. The fact that it's kind of happening whilst they're building the atomic bomb, not secondary, but very much kind of the focus is on the man. Because when you're talking about... One of the things I wanted to talk about when discussing this horrific weapon that caused so much death and so much fear for the coming decades, and that I remember from my life growing up with the kind of the fear of. I grew up quite near to a nuclear bunker, so it was all when you're a young child having a picnic next to the, oh, if there's an atomic bomb, everyone will go down there. And kind of, yeah, so you have that fear in the back of your head. I wanted to make sure that the point of this play is that the people who built this bomb were human beings. This was this wasn't something that came from outside of who we are. It was done by people who feel and think much as we do now, and it was an act of man, the bombings, and I think that's something that's important to recognise. So the personal story became more and more important for me.
To pick up on that, it's interesting. There's been cutting because the play was long, and it's absolutely standard that would happen. But often, what Tom says to me is. He says, you can't just cut it because it's not plot. We've got to. It's more important to Tom that we keep the character stuff in than the plot stuff. So we've got a responsibility to make sure everybody understands what's going on. But from your point of view, in terms of it would be so easy to take a play that's 4 hours long and say, well, we need the moment when they discover this and when they build that and when they do that. But that's not what we've done, I hope. Guy, very much not what you've done. And in answer to your original question, let's not get seduced by film and television. Historically, characters walk on stage, talk to the audience, talk to somebody else. I was maybe lucky to come out of King Lear because Edgar, just if he wants to talk to the audience, he talks to the audience. He can be absolutely terrified. People running around trying to kill him, and he'll still stop and go, right, so what I reckon is this. So you can do it as well with the physics. If there comes a point where a character on stage thinks the audience don't know about the thing that we've just talked about, that character's allowed to go, right, so you probably want to know why it's so difficult building a nuclear bomb. And he does that. Jack Holden is the actor, and it's Wilson is the character who built Fermilab in America. He was one of the youngest, and he went on to be one of the preeminent scientists of his generation. And you'll feel it, and it's very, very satisfying. But I don't think it undermines the fact that he then... Well, I don't want to give plot away, right? I can say this. He's the one who confronts Oppie and says, Oppenheimer, says, should we really be building this bomb to its conclusion? But not five scenes before, he's been very entertainingly say to the audience, how much stuff do we need? We don't know. It's all difficult. And everybody laughs. So hopefully, and particularly in this theatre company, combining... people talking to the audience, people talking to each other, 20 people on stage or one or two people on stage is a given.
Going back to that sort of structure and the things it enables you to do, one, it's a very fast play. It's a speedy play.
I wrote a lot. The actors have to speak very fast.
Yeah, well, that's when
they don't want any more of their lines cut.
It's a very... it's the length of the play. It's a good... Three hours with the interval?
It's exactly 3 hours with the interval.
With the interval. So it's a good old read. But the speed that you, in your staging decisions, managed, and it might be from Tom's original writing, that's my interest in terms of what things do you feed into Tom's script that might change? I'm thinking about the first scene when we are taken from, the fundraising party for Spain, war relief, into the university world, and it's swift, and it's, again, without giving too much away, without giving too many, but it gives us a background, but there's a lot of information being given, there's a lot of background to everybody's story being given. How do you cram so much into a script, and how do you actually physically make that happen within 3 hours?
I think when I wrote the opening split scene, so what is it, the first 10 minutes or something, that it splits between this fundraiser for the relief effort in Spain and the University of California physics department. I wanted to introduce 80% of the main characters. I wanted to introduce the politics and the science and all the relationships all at once, because there's no point going into a play like this tentatively. So you grab your audience, you throw them in, and we'll work it out as we go along. It's fine. So you're really thrown in at the deep end, and we throw a lot at you. And then it all, as the characters come back later in the play, and you kind of, they're already familiar to you, though you may not remember exactly what the relationships are, but you're already in the world. You're there feet first, right at the beginning, I think. So that was the intention anyway.
So I think, I mean, there's kind of two questions in there. I didn't feed anything into the script in those terms. It arrived with the single most difficult opening I've ever encountered in a play. And I think it's okay to talk about it because within 2 minutes you'll see it anyway, so it's not spoiling anything.
That's right.
They go between a party and the physics lab and a party and the physics lab and a party and the physics lab. And some of the characters are the same and some are different. It's written like a movie. It's written like it can just, like we can just cut. Like I can just make 15 actors disappear when Tom doesn't need them for his next scene. And then they can all just come back again when he needs them again. And it took weeks and weeks and weeks. And you'll see what we do. And I think it's a very good solution. Because I think when you see a play, it's got, I gather there are, when the actors told me there are 68 scenes, so they're not numbered, so I don't know that. Is that right?
It's something like that, yeah.
Yeah. You can't, as a, you're laughing at the fact we don't
no,
know.
No, I'm laughing at the fact I'm now looking it up.
Right. I should know. Any young
it's 68,
directors?
It is. Six, yes.
There's 68 scenes. And you, so obviously, you can do the maths. If every scene change takes 20 seconds, that's another, I can't do the maths, but a huge amount of time that you're sitting watching nothing, what people moving furniture around. Thrust stage, you don't want to put too much furniture in there. Anyone who saw Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, I think there's maybe like a cart and a chair. Because as soon as you put furniture here, the person over there can't see through it. So it's not very helpful. So Shakespearean stage, you have to move it quickly. And also I think in terms of attacking a piece of new writing, the last thought in a scene feeds to the first thought in the next scene. Oppie gets a promotion, and the next thing that happens is we see the most senior member of the army saying that he's looking to get involved. So you want to put them, the power of the cut, you want to put them next to each other. So you do it with no fuss, and you find the theatrical colour elsewhere, in video, in lighting, in brilliant acting, in lots of people on stage, in people dancing, in people singing songs. The songs were all in the script when it arrived with me. So what you don't do is you say, well, for this scene, I need a table and three chairs, and wouldn't it be nice if they were drinking tea and somebody could turn on the light and open a window? It's just not available to you.
Can we talk about, without, because everybody knows it happens, that's the great thing about history play, but in terms of the biggest challenge, probably from having read the script as well, is the testing moment when the bomb goes off, which there is a description that you've written, which is very filmic in its...
Well, yeah, it's kind of, I always like to chuck in one moment into a stage direction which kind of says, all right, director, whoever you may be, this will define the style of the production, yeah. This one moment. I've no idea how you're going to do it. I think the first play I wrote...
One moment. You think there's one moment?
There's one big moment. My first play I wrote, there was a scene set inside of a biological weapons testing facility, and I needed a monkey to die in a cage.
You didn't get that one.
Yeah. Yeah, or you've written another play where somebody has to keep a goldfish alive for a whole scene while it's flopping around on the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
With a spray.
Yeah. So there's always kind of one moment that I think, I don't know how you're going to do that. Let's see what let the director's brain kind of work on that.
So I'm going to pass it to you and say, how did your brain start to work on that challenge?
Well, it's... So what we're talking about is, as you will know... they tested the bomb, Trinity test, in the desert. They'd built this very complicated bomb and they had no idea whether it was going to work or not. They hoped it was going to work. And so it's very nice. What I did is I went to my designer. You spend ages in your I do anyway. The designer, Robert Innes Hopkins, is here somewhere, has a studio and he puts stuff in a model box and you go and look at it. And then the day comes where you say, let's make sure we can achieve everything that we need to achieve. And you sit over this idea that you've got to detonate a nuclear bomb, which clearly would have wiped out all of Stratford, to say the least. So you can't do it for real. but you can't. You can't do like the light from the bomb. It's completely compelling in that they were 17 miles away. Sound travels at 330 metres per second, which means it takes about 5 seconds for it to cover a kilometre or a mile. Again, I can't do the maths on the back, but it would have taken a minute for the sound to reach them. The shockwave would have travelled quicker. This is all irrelevant, but I find it fascinating. The light, of course, they would have seen immediately. Then they would have seen the mushroom cloud. A minute or 2 minutes later, they would have heard the explosion. In between that, they'd have been hit by a shockwave, which would have broken all the glass in their windscreens or whatever. You can't do any of that. I can't even... If I put as much light out there, I'd be infringing, or you'd all be blinded. So we've done something entirely figurative. But it came from the script. I don't want to give it away.
No. I mean, we'll wait for it.
Richard Feynman, the much-mentioned Richard Feynman, who I think was 19 or 20 when he worked on the project. So he was a student doing back-of-envelope calculations. He then became the greatest physicist for my generation, looking up. He died in the, 80s or 90s?
Yeah, 89, I think.
Also played the bongos. Famously played the bongos. If you go on YouTube, you can see Richard Feynman playing the bongos, and it's fabulous. So we had to do a poetic version. Can I stop there?
Yes. Perfect. So, those of you who have seen it, it just absolutely takes you to that place, I think.
Yeah, it's a cool moment. Tom would have to take 80, 90% of the credit.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we've spoken for lots of it. If you have any questions, please shoot your hand up. We're being recorded for archive, so I will repeat the question before they jump. Right, so it's a question about, during the play, there are lots of formulae written, and it looks very authentic. How authentic is it, and how easy was it for the actors to get into that groove?
For me, really, this one is. Yeah. So that's none of that's in the script. They're all completely authentic. We went back to the papers of the time. There's famous equations like the Born-Oppenheimer, or even Maxwell's equations, field equations. I mean, it's easy to find this stuff online, but what you get is a wall of equations. So Dave Walk, who was my tutor and is now a professor of particle physics, went through it for us so that they're all period and accurate, and the actors all wrote them, and Dave walked around like a sort of art school teacher going, oh, yeah, that bracket needs to be more squiggly, or, you know, you've taken that to the power of n, and it needs to be the power of n minus 1. And I did a bit the same, because I'm used to doing them. How difficult were they to learn? We gave them in December because they were opening Shoemaker's Holiday, and I didn't want to get in trouble with the Shoemaker's director by giving them all equations as they were in his tech. Sandy, who's brilliant, who plays Charlotte Serber, somebody said, oh, how are we going to learn them all? And she said, you don't have to know what you mean. You just have to learn them, you know, like lines. And that's very much what they've done. But
I hadn't heard that.
Have you not? And I shouldn't have named her, should I? An anonymous member of the company. I think, you know, every bracket that opens, closes. We went round, me and Dave, and told them very, very roughly. So if somebody's got a field equation, they know that it's about electromagnetic fields. If somebody's got an equation to do with the energy. So Tom, who plays Hans Better, writes one on the floor down here, which is to do with whether or not they're going to ignite the Earth's atmosphere. It's taken from Teller's paper, delivered to Oppenheimer from the project, about how they definitely can't ignite the atmosphere, and it's nitrogen fusion. And I'm very proud of the fact that it's absolutely accurate.
A bit of research being done there. Okay, so a question about the ethics. Very personal question. Yeah, in terms of whether you feel... That must drive your... Well, it does drive a huge part of the play in terms of the ethics, the struggle, if it's possible, it's inevitable line.
Yeah, and I'm still struggling with that question because it's one of those big unanswerable things. They did something that they thought at the time was the right thing to do. Dave Walk was always talking about how an atomic bomb... to us, with hindsight, is a much more frightening prospect than it would have been at the time. Because we are aware of how long radiation can hang around for, and the long-term effects of radiation exposure, which they weren't that concerned about at the time. They knew that about acute radiation damage, so if you suffered from radiation, you die. But from radiation exposure, you die. But if you had that amount of radiation, you would have been killed by the blast anyway. So there is the. There's a whole, there's a whole lot of hindsight with the peculiar fear of nuclear weapons that we have that they wouldn't have had at the time, and so I was trying to keep that in the play. But Oppenheimer's always talking about, and this is kind of his philosophy in real life, was he believed that that he saved the world from World War III, pretty much. Because it was possible, it was inevitable. Without the atomic bomb ending the Second World War, chances are there would have been a World War III between the Russians and the Americans in the 50s, and we'd have had hydrogen bombs by then. And so not just hundreds of thousands of people would have died, but millions, possibly billions, possibly all of us. So how on earth you weigh up 100,000 people here versus everyone else, it's not a decision I would ever like. No one would ever like to kind of be put into that position. But it's unanswerable, and it's neither right nor wrong. It's just horrific.
Gosh, I don't know what. When I was a student of physics, I suppose we were all at the top of our game. If somebody had gone, come and work on this project. I don't know. I don't think I could even fly a plane that dropped a bomb. I mean, they were blanket bombing at the time. So the idea of creating a bomb that was 10 times as powerful as the bombs they were already using wasn't... It's not a singular... It's what it is a very effective way to flatten a city. They were already... It would be no strange thought to bomb, to drop 10 bombs, each a tenth of the size of a nuclear bomb. It was a strategic thing to be able for it to be won. Fewer people had to risk their lives. Could I do it? I don't know. I'd have to spend a lot of time thinking about the rights and wrongs, and I don't know whether I'd ever get to the bottom of it. One of the things that that they say on there's a brilliant documentary if anybody's interested on YouTube called The Day After Trinity, and they talk about the patriotic fervour that they felt. And they say nobody could understand that now. If I felt it was to protect my loved ones, against them. I mean, this is very much subject to the play. Against the Nazis, knowing.
Wasn't at the start there.
No. That's not. Ultimately, yeah. I mean, that's very much the subject to the play. I mean, initially, if Hitler was doing what he's doing, and you thought that you had a skill that could stop him when nobody else could.
At a time when the Germans were the world leaders in particle physics, and they had people like Werner Heisenberg, who was generally considered the top most genius of the time. It was kind of, that they've got that. Mm.
Richard Feynman said to, my tutor studied with Feynman, so generations down, and Feynman said, the thing is, you ask us why we didn't stop when the war in Europe ended, it never occurred to any of us to stop. And he said, you can judge that. And Feynman used to sit on the anniversary day in his study, on whatever university campus in America he was a professor of, open all the doors and said, anybody, come and talk to me and ask me. But what he said to Dave was, we were so caught up in it. That didn't really answer your question.
If the timing had been different, would they have considered using the bomb in Europe? Was that...
That was the plan originally, and I did a lot of research into this, and quite a lot of what they were saying was that, in some ways, because of the propaganda at the time and the way that the Japanese were quite racistly depicted in the propaganda at the time, it was considered an easier sell to the American public to bomb Japan than it would have been to bomb the white faces of Europe.
Wow. I don't think
it's also the case they could have, you'll see, or you may know, that the first bomb was a uranium bomb, the second was a plutonium bomb. The reason they put so much effort into developing a plutonium bomb, you can build loads and loads of those. Uranium is very hard to get hold of. They thought they were going to need 10 of these to drop on. I mean, it's hard to judge retrospectively, but in order to win against Germany, they wanted lots of these bombs. So that's why they put so much of their resources into developing the plutonium bomb, so they could create many, many of these. If they thought they were only going to need a couple, they probably could have just built a second uranium bomb. So however we judge retrospectively what they actually would have done, their plan was to build lots.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I think this play, we're doing what this play is actually doing to the audience, is that people going away having conversations. I find it interesting that as influence into Shakespeare is that it's a tragedy. It starts off, there's a lot of enthusiasm. It's a fun play to watch. Now we're talking very heavily about what if and the actual outcome of that with hindsight, but when the play isn't like that, but we get taken along, sort of the flawed genius is the phrase that you kind of want to use about Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. We know the answers, but it's very interesting. It's a fantastic production. I hope it goes on to somewhere else. I think those of you that have seen it would probably agree with me, and that's why you're here. Thank you very much to Tom and Angus for opening up a little bit about their rehearsal process and writing.
Thank you. Thank you.